Nice guy.
Like you, my darling. Far too nice to be a DCI.
Well, I'm going no higher up that ladder, more money or not. I want to be a policeman. Things are already getting dodgy. I'm constantly being reminded to delegate so I can spend more time on risk assessment and health and safety procedures. He grimaced. Not what I had in mind when I joined the force. Kay smiled warmly at him.
You love it. You know you do.
Cameron frowned. In truth, the job wasn't what it was a few years back. There were so many areas where he believed they were letting the public down, mainly through lack of funds and manpower. He loved the job, but for how much longer? Chapter 21. Jackman, Laura, and Sam waited until James arrived home from work, so as to back up what Ella had decided. Though privately Jackman thought his brother would agree with anything Ella said, simply because he was incapable of deciding for himself. He seemed to have lost all ability to concentrate on anything except business. Knowing how their father had behaved for most of their lives, Jackman knew he couldn't change him, but it still hurt to see what James was doing to his sons. Ella had opted to stay in Raynham Lodge as long as there was a police presence there, and Jackman had rung Ruth Crook to arrange it. It was gone midnight by the time he got back to Mill Corner, and now he was in early to prepare the daily orders. He wanted to get on with the interviews as swiftly as possible. They would start with the Simmons family, and then tackle the followers that had continued to support them over the years. Unfortunately, he was one officer down. Rosie had been signed off for a week, and when she would be fully fit to work again was anyone's guess. Jackman hoped that it was a temporary problem, but he kept thinking about Ella and how she'd walked off the job and never returned. Deep in thought, he jumped when his desk phone rang.
"Dear Jackman, how can I help?"
"It's more of a question of what I can do to help you." Jackman recognized the deep voice of Cameron Walker and breathed a sigh of relief.
"I've got two officers that I can put at your disposal if that helps.
Oh, and one of them is me. Plus I'll do the liaising directly, so that will free up another of your detectives."
"Music to my ears, Cam. We have a string of people to interview and I get the feeling that time is not on our side. I can almost hear the killer's mind ticking over as he decides what horror to present us with next."
"There aren't too many people left who were involved in that trial. Did you hear about Judge Henry?"
Jackman said he had. "At least he was spared the wrath of our grim reaper."
"Was he? I wonder." Cam drew in a breath. "Word on the grapevine says he changed a few years back, became unsettled, and started drinking heavily. Maybe our man was quietly getting at him."
"That could well be the truth," Jackman said. "Thing is, I can't see him stopping, can you?
With no righteous cause to fight for, maybe he's run his course," Cam said.
"I don't believe that for a moment."
"Nor do I. But maybe there's a tiny chance he was only out to fulfill an oath of retribution. Once that's done, he'll close the book." Cam grunted. "Anyway, we can continue this debate when I get to you. We'll be there in half an hour, okay?" Jackman thanked him and hung up. Cameron's help would make things easier. He was a very astute detective and had a reputation for dealing well with difficult interviews.
"Something is actually going my way," Jackman whispered to himself.
"You know what they say about talking to yourself?" Marie grinned at him. "Morning, boss." She placed two coffees on his desk. He looked up at her and smiled.
"You're early, and I'm very pleased you are."
He gestured to a chair and proceeded to tell her about the events of the previous evening. He showed her Miles's picture.
"My God, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? And he's only 7? He draws better than me."
She took the picture from him and stared at it. Jackman watched her eyes linger on the bad man. Had she seen something there too?
Why?
Marie frowned.
Why do I think that I should recognize that figure? Is it a cartoon character? Or someone from a film?
She looked up at Jackman with a puzzled expression on her face.
I felt the same. But a whole night of lying awake, going over all the possibilities, has produced nothing but mental exhaustion.
Marie put the drawing back on his desk.
It will come to me, I'm sure.
And we can ask the others when they get in. Maybe one of them will know. She sipped the hot coffee.
I've been awake too, trying to look at our killer from a different perspective. I'm wondering if I might try a slightly different approach.
Jackman smiled.
All suggestions gratefully received. And we have Cameron Walker and one of his team joining us today, so we are back up to full power. Tell me more about your thoughts.
While the interviews with the Simmons family and their cohorts are going on, I wondered if I might be allowed to dig deeper into the family histories of Lindsay Ashcroft and her contemporaries. I know the others have been looking at the trial and all the media comments about it, but there is precious little in the old files about Lindsay herself. Perhaps I can turn up something that leads to the source of the killer's reign of terror.
She scratched her head.
And I'm going to approach it as if Brendan Simmons really was telling the truth, if that's okay.
It could just throw up someone else lurking in the shadows.
Jackman considered her suggestion.
Absolutely. I agree entirely. Someone has made it his life's work to bring down everyone who was connected with the case. His motive has to be about as strong and hate-driven as it's possible to get.
Hate-driven. Interesting use of words.
Marie stared at him.
I was thinking more about being driven by love.
A double-edged sword, I believe. If he loved either Lindsay or Brendan, then that could transmute into hate for those who brought about their deaths.
And his voyage into vengeance begins.
They sat in silence for a moment or two.
Use Gary. He's good at reading people, said Jackman at last. I'll take the rest of the team and our colleagues from Beach Lacey, and we'll talk to everyone involved with Sheila Simmons's campaign. You never know, we might just find someone who overlaps with your historical inquiries. That suit you?
Great, thank you.
Marie finished her coffee and stood up.
I'm sorry you feel your family could be under threat, Jackman. But that event in the park took place well before Sarah died.
Jackman sighed. Oh, didn't I tell you? The boys have seen him twice since then. And the second time was 2 days ago, outside the school. Jackman thought he should talk to Sheila Simmons first, and under the circumstances, decided he would do it alone. He felt that she might open up more, one-to-one. Knowing how ill she was, he had rung ahead, but she insisted he come immediately. On the drive to Nettleby Oaks, he tried to formulate his questions. He was aware that Sheila did not have long to live, and this might be the only interview. He was invited in by a vet, and he was careful not to mention her visit to the station. He climbed the stairs, and Kenny met him outside his mother's room.
Mom's having a good day today, but please don't overdo it. The good days are few and far between.
Jackman assured him he would keep it brief, and Kenny opened the door for him. Sheila was propped up on a mountain of pillows, looking considerably brighter than when Jackman had last seen her.
I've spoken to the whole family, Detective Inspector, and I've requested they share anything with you that might help your investigation.
I appreciate that, Mrs. Simmons.
Not that Liam or Dale will be anything other than hostile, I'm sure.
Her tone was almost apologetic.
They have the campaign in their blood. They'll never give up.
She pulled herself up.
And even though I know I won't be around to see an outcome, I'm glad they'll keep trying.
Jackman sat in a chair close to her bed.
Tell me about Brendan.
Her face softened.
You've heard the term angels with dirty faces, I'm sure. Well, that was my boy. A little terror, but he had a heart of gold. He was a cheeky devil, but he charmed people. Brendan never killed Lindsay, although I know they went together, if you understand my meaning.
Jackman nodded. So, did you ever have any suspicions about who did kill her?
Sheila sighed.
We've been over this a million times. If we could have provided another name, then maybe Brendan would have been exonerated. But no, the few people we did wonder about all had watertight alibis.
Jackman looked at her. The man who is killing people connected to the trial is ruthless, cunning, and has no human values whatsoever.
Sheila shook her head.
The people who help us are all ferociously loyal, but we've always done everything by the book. We've used the media, organized vigils and protests, and written more letters than there are chapters in the Bible.
She smoothed the bed cover with stiff, knobbly fingers.
Liam has sometimes been confrontational, and he's had a few fights, but no one I know of would stoop to anything like murder.
She gave him a searching look.
It was murder that brought us to where we are now. Can you honestly see us falling that low?
No, I can't, Jackman said. But someone has, so we need to talk to everyone who either knew Lindsay or Brendan, or had a connection with the outcome of the murder trial. Has anyone you've come across during your campaign ever seemed overzealous, possibly manic, in the way they've spoken?
We were all hot-blooded to start with. We fought hard for Brendan and we believed we'd win.
Tears welled up in her eyes.
Who would have dreamed it would go on this long? And we're no nearer than we were at the start.
Jackman handed her a box of tissues from the bedside table. That is why we now have to investigate everything again. To try to discover who this killer is. If it's any consolation, I believe the truth will come out this time. Although it may not be exactly what you want to hear. For a moment, Sheila didn't answer. Then she said,
If the truth comes out, then you'll find that my son was not guilty. I couldn't have gone on for so long if I didn't believe that.
Whatever the outcome, I promise to tell you everything we uncover, and I truly hope we can give you closure.
I hope that happens. It may come too late for me, but it would mean my children could finally be allowed to live their lives without committing so much of them to their dead brother.
They seem very different from each other, your children, in looks and temperament.
Oh, they are. But then they are all adopted. My husband and I fostered dozens of abandoned and damaged children, and these are the ones I couldn't let go. Brendan was my only natural child.
I see. This struck Jackman as important, but he couldn't say why. Finally, Mrs. Simmons, is there anyone in your group of supporters that bothers or worries you in any way? She was silent for a while.
There were a few people who didn't exactly bother me, but I never quite took to them. We had a young man called Jeremy Shaw, an intelligent chap, but I was never truly certain about his motivations. I was told that he studied theology and had gone into the church, but had suffered a crisis of faith and left. I wondered if taking up our cause was a substitute for what he'd lost.
She paused again.
And although I should never criticize Mark, that's Mark Courtney, he's been my spokesman for years. I still find him puzzling. He practically took over the whole thing at one point, but I always wondered why. He never even knew Brendan.
Sheila was starting to look tired, and Jackman brought the meeting to a close. As he got to the door, she said,
You're different, aren't you?
He stopped and smiled back at her.
I hope so.
So do I.
Sheila lay back and closed her eyes.
I believe you're our last hope.
How's Rosie? Robbie asked Max. Pretty grim, mate, if I'm honest.
Max flopped down into a chair in the CID room and yawned.
I've been up half the night with her.
I thought the doc gave her something to help her sleep.
She wouldn't take it, the stubborn little mare. I told her she really needed help, but she'd have none of it.
He shook his head. She hates taking tablets. Said she'd seen too much of what drugs do to people.
I can understand that. But a mild sedative would hardly have her hooked for life.
Robbie smiled.
But she is stubborn, I'll give you that.
Immovable. One good thing, her eldest sister has come over to keep an eye on her. She's a force of nature, and Rosie adores her.
So, hopefully...
Try not to worry, Max. Rosie will come through this, I'm convinced of it.
I did when I had a really bad time, and to be honest, I don't think I have nearly as much strength of character as Rosie. So hang on in there, my friend.
Max swallowed and sighed heavily.
It kind of puts things into perspective.
Like how much you really care for someone? Asked Robbie gently.
Bang on target. I mean, I knew I was pretty smitten, but hell.
Dare I mention the word love? Robbie grinned.
With bells on.
Then you'll see her through. Robbie leaned forward and grasped his friend's shoulder. And if I can help, just let me know. I'm here for you, both of you.
For a minute, Robbie thought the tough Cockney was going to burst into tears. Then Max shook himself.
Tell mate, appreciate it. And now I guess we'd better get some work done, huh?
Fancy interviewing some suspects for our DIY killer? Robbie asked.
Max winced.
DIY killer? Gross, man. Don't tell me you came up with that one.
Robbie held up his hands.
No way, is what the mess room are calling him.
So, are you in? Because I've got a couple of names here that the boss wants us to talk to.
Max looked at the names on the memo Robbie showed him.
Christian Ventner and Sean Cooper. Who are they?
Ventner is one of Sheila Simmons' crusaders, and Cooper is a local guy who never joined the protest group, but he had a lot to say to the media. Very much an activist, but more of a loner by the sound of it.
Max rubbed his hands together.
Right. Then we'd better go talk to them, I guess.
It took 15 minutes to reach the village of Saltville and Christian Ventner's house. Max whistled.
Nice pad. Wonder what this guy does for a living.
Robbie glanced at his notes.
Architect, I think.
He looked up at the Georgian house.
But he sure didn't design this.
The house was a beautiful example of the middle-class homes of that era. Robbie reconsidered his preference for modern houses.
Are you thinking of just memorizing this property, mate? Or shall we ring the bell?
Robbie laughed.
Sorry, daydreaming.
He rang the bell and stepped back. Christian Ventner took a while to answer, but when he did, he merely glanced at their ID and swung the door wide open.
Come in, this way, gentlemen.
He ushered Robbie and Max into an elegant sitting room. The focal point was an arched, cast-iron fireplace, set in an intricately carved wooden surround.
Robbie liked it.
Lovely house, sir. Family home, officer. But even though it's just me left, I can't part with it.
Ventner was a tall, thin man. He wore his hair rather too long for someone in their mid-40s. His skin was pale, his eyes a washed-out blue, but he radiated energy.
Please, sit and tell me why you are here.
He indicated two armchairs, while he sat on the arm of the sofa, obliging them to look up to him. Robbie wondered if this was intentional.
We need to speak to you about your involvement with the people trying to clear Brendan Simmons's name.
Ventner frowned.
What have they done now? Has that damn fool Liam got himself into trouble?
Max shook his head. They've done nothing, sir. But there have been some incidents recently that seem to be related to the Ashcroft murder trial.
Incidents? His pale eyes flashed.
Sorry, sir, we can't say any more at this stage in our investigation, Robbie interposed. But if you could just tell us why you joined the campaign.
I strongly believe in fair play, Detective, and I don't like to think of an innocent man suffering for something he didn't do, like Brendan suffered, to the point of taking his own life.
This campaign has run for years, sir. Even though it's got nowhere, you still keep trying?
Robbie looked at him. Ventnor sat up straight.
Of course. When you believe in something, really believe in it, you don't give up. Wars were not won by throwing in the towel, young man.
This sounded pompous and very patronizing to Robbie.
Have you always lived here, sir?
Asked Max.
In the family home?
Oh, no. I travelled a lot when I was younger. I worked all over the country. I only settled back here when my father died. I supported my mother through a long illness until she passed away. Now, here I am.
He looked around the room.
Home alone.
No brothers or sisters?
One sister, but she was killed on a backpacker's holiday in Asia. As I said, there is only me now.
He shifted on the arm of the sofa.
Forgive me for asking, but it seems I'm being interviewed, and I have no idea why. Is this normal procedure?
We appreciate your assistance, sir. I'm sorry we can't say much at present, but I can assure you it's a serious matter.
Two detectives. Sounds like murder to me. He looked from Max to Robbie, who both returned his gaze impassively.
But, as you say, you can't tell me anything.
You're an architect, sir?
A project architect. I'm self-employed now, but I work with a company that designs homes in the fusion style.
The two detectives looked blank.
It combines art with nature and science. It's interesting and quite challenging work.
Why do you believe that Brendan Simmons was innocent?
Robbie asked abruptly.
The question seemed to disconcert Ventnor.
He answered almost angrily.
Because it was clearly a travesty of justice. Any fool could see that. There wasn't nearly enough evidence, and what was presented was questionable.
The jury clearly didn't agree with you there. So you followed the case from day one?
Robbie's tone was harder now.
Ventnor shifted again.
I suppose I did.
Why? Why were you so interested in it? Did you know Brendan personally, or maybe you knew Lindsay Ashcroft?
Robbie persisted.
No, I didn't, and I object to this kind of questioning.
Ventnor stood up.
I think you should leave now.
And if you need to come back, make an appointment and I'll have my solicitor with me.
After the door slammed shut behind them, Max began to chuckle.
Nice one, Robbo. That got him miffed.
So what did you think of him?
Robbie asked.
Pompous prat. He's clearly twitchy, but I wonder why.
I'd say he was personally involved, Robbie said.
Why so much interest, right from the beginning, and then keep at it all this time?
He knew one or both of them, I'm certain, he shrugged.
But I can't see him as our DIY man, can you?
Max looked back at the house.
I can't. I didn't like him, but that doesn't make him a killer.
So,
Robbie started the car,
on to check out Mr. Sean Cooper.
Can hardly wait. Hope he's not like that one. Wars weren't won by throwing in the towel, young man. Supercilious old git.
Marie and Gary were combing through the past, their desks scattered with printouts and copies of old newspaper articles.
I'm starting to get a feel for what life was like in that small village back in those days,
Gary said.
Me too, and boy, it was claustrophobic.
Marie grimaced. Gary grinned at her.
Incestuous, even. Such a small community and everyone related to everyone else.
It was much worse a couple of generations ago, when few people travelled outside the village.
Marie was looking at her screen.
Finally, I found something on Lindsay Ashcroft. There's a background report here, done at the time of her death, along with a short bio from her class teacher. She printed them out and handed copies to Gary. They read in silence. Marie said, "Nothing screams out at me." This bio is a bit, what's the word, sterile, isn't it? I mean, this poor young girl has just been horribly murdered, and whoever wrote this might have been copying out the shipping forecast. You'd think a bit of emotion might have trickled through, wouldn't you? Maybe the teacher who wrote it was affected, and was trying to keep to the facts. It's not supposed to win the Booker Prize. Gary snorted. You know what I mean. Good at sport, liked animals. I don't think this teacher liked Lindsay Ashcroft much. Marie read it again. I see what you mean. It isn't exactly warm and friendly, is it? Gary skimmed the police report. I get the feeling this lass was a bit of a Billy No-Mates. I wonder why that was. Marie shrugged. Crap family, crap house, too ashamed to bring friends home. Or she could have been a bully, and the other kids steered clear. Gary looked up. We need to find out. It could have a bearing on the case. Okay, let's get phoning and see if we can trace someone who remembers her. 10 minutes later, Marie put down the receiver. Got one. The local post office put me in touch with an old neighbour. I've rung her, and she'll talk to us. Excellent. When? Now. Well, as soon as we can get there. Marie stood up. Let's go. I'm dying to find out what Lindsay was really like. Mrs. Beatrice Harper's home was a small, neat bungalow, set in a large corner plot. Gary looked around, lost in admiration. Beatrice met them at the gate and greeted them cheerfully. She was dressed for gardening, in green corduroy trousers, a check shirt, and a quilted half-jacket with more pockets than a fishing gilet.
Let me get these boots off and we'll go inside.
Inside the back door, she hauled off her wellies with a grunt.
I do love my garden, but at 83 it's beginning to get the better of me, I must admit.
Gary was amazed. Your garden is a picture you've put me to shame.
You're a working man. I have all the time in the world except for my craft classes. Oh, and the film club.
Beatrice bustled into the kitchen and put the kettle on.
I'll get us some tea. You are proper police officers, I take it. You do like a brew?
They nodded vigorously. Nothing like it, said Marie.
You two go through to the conservatory and make yourselves at home. I'll bring the tea.
Gary followed Marie into the garden room through a lounge diner, vastly impressed by how clean it all was. Plenty of older folk lacked the energy for dusting or hoovering, he knew, but evidently not Beatrice. They sat in cane chairs and looked out at the garden. Surely it was too big for an 83-year-old to cope with, yet somehow she seemed to be managing, and very well. Gary just hoped her memory was in as good nick. Beatrice arrived with a tray of tea and chocolate digestive biscuits.
Dig in and tell me what you want to know.
Marie helped herself to a mug of tea and a biscuit.
We need to get a clear picture of what Lindsay Ashcroft was like. Do you think you can help us, Mrs. Harper?
I certainly can. And is Beatrice, please. I've only lived here for, around 5 years, I suppose. Before that, when my husband was alive, we lived next door to the Ashcrofts. Ash Grange, it was called. Rather ostentatious, but it was a big property.
They were well off? Asked Marie.
Charles Ashcroft was a businessman. Something in the building trade, I think. Not a friendly man at all.
Beatrice's bright face clouded over.
My husband fell out with him, I'm afraid.
What was the wife like, Lindsay's mother? Asked Gary, nibbling a digestive.
We never really knew her. She ran off one day, never came back. Not that we blamed her, really.
All the shouting and screaming that used to come from that house, it was terrible. Beatrice shook her head. We worried about the children.
Gary stared at her, surprised.
Children? Yes, Lindsay and her little brother, Alistair.
Marie gave Gary a puzzled glance.
None of the reports mentioned a brother.
Beatrice put her mug down.
No wonder, poor little thing. They said he was autistic. He had behavioural problems. He was treated really badly by the other children at school, and if Lindsay hadn't looked out for him, I dread to think what would have happened.
I wonder what did happen to him, Gary mused. Beatrice shrugged.
I have no idea. After Lindsay died, Charles put him in a special school and never saw him again.
The alarm bells were clanging in Gary's head, and from the look on her face, Marie heard them too.
Lindsay,
Beatrice hesitated.
I know I shouldn't speak ill of the dead, but she was a bit of a wild child. She did her best for Alistair, I know, but she bullied him too. He was a strange little thing, and he idolized her, but she rarely had a good word to say to him. Ali was the reason my husband argued with Charles. We knew he sometimes took his belt to the boy, but we didn't want to make it worse for the poor little mite. Eventually, Harry read Charles the Riot Act, but it did no good. We were about to go to the authorities when Lindsay was murdered.
Marie leaned forward.
You said the girl was wild? In what way, Beatrice?
Boys, mostly. She would sneak out at night. We could see her go from our bedroom window. What she never knew, or so we believed, was that little Ali would follow her. God knows what hanky-panky that poor child witnessed.
The reports say that the night she went with Brendan Simmons, it was her first time. Does that sound right to you, given her behaviour? Gary asked.
When I said she liked the boys, I meant she was a terrible flirt and an awful tease, not that she went any further. I saw the statements and I thought they were probably the truth. She was little more than a child.
Did you know Brendan? Marie asked.
Yes, not well, but he did odd jobs for us once or twice. We liked him.
What did you think of the verdict?
Beatrice sighed.
Heartbreaking. Brendan had always seemed such a fun-loving boy. He did like Lindsay, he told us that much himself. But kill her? I don't know, I really don't. I would never have believed it, but the two girls who witnessed it were good, honest children. Why would they lie?
You knew them, too?
Marie was surprised.
I knew Pauline's parents well, and Heather was always in and out of our house as a little one. I sometimes wonder how she is. I know why they ran away, but I would love to hear from her again.
Gary bit his lip. They couldn't tell the old lady that Heather and Pauline had both been driven to suicide. It would be too cruel. After a quick glance at Gary, Marie said,
Beatrice, what happened to Charles Ashcroft?
Oh, he's dead, dear. Not long after Lindsay was killed. Got drunk and drove off the road at speed. Went nose down in a deep drainage ditch and broke his neck.
There was no sadness in her voice this time. Gary thought of the mysterious younger brother.
Where was he now?
You said that Alistair used to follow Lindsay.
Did you see him follow her on the night she was attacked?
We weren't here that night, I'm afraid. We had gone to our daughter's for the evening.
She gasped.
Are you saying that little Ali might have witnessed... Oh, that's too awful.
Please don't upset yourself. It's just that he might have seen her with someone.
Why did I never think about that before? That poor child.
Marie leaned forward.
Beatrice, we need your help. Do you know anyone who could tell us where we could find Alistair Ashcroft?
The old lady frowned.
You could talk to the vicar.
He had a friend, another clergyman who was covering this parish at the time of the murder. He spent a lot of time with the people of Nettleby and Nettleby Oaks. Everyone was in shock, and he was a tower of strength. He did go up to Ash Grange to try and help Charles, but I don't think he was made to feel very welcome.
But he might have heard something about where the boy was sent.
They thanked Beatrice and apologized for upsetting her.
You've been a great help, Marie said. Now we have something concrete to work on. We do appreciate it.
I can't think why I've never asked myself that question before. I suppose hearing what happened to Lindsay just pushed it out of my mind. Ali didn't always follow her, but he very often did.
And then his father suddenly sent him away, Gary breathed. What did that boy see?
I dread to think,
Beatrice said somberly.
But if you do find him, he might not be the most reliable of witnesses, you know. He was a strange child, so he could well be a very disturbed adult.
Marie smiled. We must go. Thank you again for all your help and for the tea and biscuits.
Any time you're passing, I'm nearly always here.
Beatrice looked at each of them, and her voice fell to a whisper.
Something terrible has happened, hasn't it? That's why you're here. The blight that set in all those years ago. It's back, isn't it?
Gary badly wanted to explain, but knew he mustn't.
You look after yourself, Beatrice. And if you ever want a job as a gardener, I've got a vacancy at my place.
She smiled sadly.
Good luck, officers. I hope you find him.
Marie drove back in record time. At the station, they practically threw themselves at their computers and began searching for Alistair Ashcroft. The rest of the team were out, apart from Charlie Button, who was eager to help.
What a stroke of luck, Sarge! You might have identified the killer in one hit. I mean, if the kid did witness his sister's death and knew it wasn't Brendan, bingo! When he grows up, he goes all out for vengeance.
Gary held up his hand. Wait. Think about it, Charlie. If he knew Brendan didn't do it, he'd have told someone, hopefully the police. He wouldn't let Brendan go to prison, then wait donkey's years for revenge, would he?
Maybe he would if he was traumatized.
Or maybe he told his father, said Marie slowly. But Daddy didn't believe him and decided to magic him away before his crazy ideas got someone into trouble.
Gary dropped into a chair.
Too many possibilities.
What do we know for sure?
Marie cleaned one of the whiteboards and picked up a marker.
Alistair Ashcroft had learning difficulties, possibly autistic, Gary stated.
Andy had a habit of following his wayward sister when she went out of an evening.
Marie wrote it down. Plus his father ill-treated him.
His mother ran out on him. The kids at school gave him a hard time, Gary continued.
Marie nodded, and even his sister, who was the only one to care for him, bullied him sometimes.
Didn't have much going on for him, did he, poor little sod?
Charlie exclaimed.
Then, according to rumour, he got stuck in a special school. What a life!
And since the father, Charles Ashcroft, is brown bread, we need to do some digging.
Marie stared pensively at the board.
Do we honestly think that someone as mentally challenged as Alistair was could possibly be our clever and calculating killer?
It's a big stretch of the imagination, that's for sure,
Gary sighed.
Not really.
Marie and Gary stared at Charlie.
It's only hearsay that he was autistic or had learning difficulties. It also might be something his father put around to cover up the fact that the kid was a mess after his mother left. What if he was clever and cunning even at that age? There was a kid at my school who was treated like a total idiot, but he turned out to be a genius, fine line and all that.
Gary nodded thoughtfully.
He has a point.
Marie stared at the name. Was this the man they were looking for? Or was he just a screwed-up kid,
deserted and abandoned by the very people who should have loved him. Time to do some detecting, folks. Gary, chase up that vicar and see what he remembers about the boy. And Charlie, try to unearth his school records and also his medical records. He must have had some sort of mental health evaluation. I'm going to ring Jackman. He needs to hear this. Chapter 22. Kenny Simmons was surprisingly easy to talk to. Jackman had envisaged a difficult interview, but after he'd made sure that his mother was asleep, he took Jackman into the lounge, closed the door, and sat back on one of the sofas. I don't even remember a time when things were just simple. All our lives, the family seems to have spent time fighting for something or other. Even when Mum and Dad wanted to adopt the younger ones, they had to battle for them. And then our Brendan was accused of that terrible crime. Kenny shook his head. It was the start of a nightmare that we never woke up from.
I can only imagine, said Jackman calmly. I'm sorry to have to rake everything up again. If there was any other way, I wouldn't be worrying your mother at this stage of her life.
More like this stage of her death, Inspector. Kenny sounded tired, as if he were doing everything on automatic. Maybe it was like that when you were waiting for someone you loved to die. Jackman could not imagine life without his mother. His father was a different story. His dad had always been more of a figurehead than a hands-on parent. He would hate to lose him. After all, you only had one father. But miss him? How could you miss someone who was never there in the first place?
Are you married, Kenny?
Kenny nodded.
Jennifer. She's a really lovely human being. Patient, too. She knows that I have to support Mum, and she's taken on everything until I get home again.
That's good. You need someone like that when things get difficult.
Jackman paused.
Kenny, I need to get a picture of the real Brendan. I've had your Mum's version. Now can I have yours? Please be as candid as you can.
Kenny was silent for a while.
We were close. But I always felt there was a part of him I didn't know. He was funny, easygoing, he liked people to think of him as a bit of a bad boy, but he was really very sweet.
He stared down at his hands clasped tight.
I knew what he had in mind that night.
Jackman tensed. He remained silent.
He borrowed a condom from me. He said he and Lindsay had decided they wanted to do it, but he was worried about getting her pregnant.
Kenny looked thoroughly miserable.
I told him to wait, but he said she was really up for it, and he didn't want to let her down. He sniffed. Jesus, how I wish he had. Stupid sod. For all his bravado, it was his first time, too.
Did Brendan have a temper?
Is there any chance that he got carried away in the heat of the moment, wanted more, maybe?
Jackman asked.
Kenny looked up at Jackman.
Brendan was the peacemaker in our family, Inspector. I never saw him lose his temper, never once.
They sat in silence for a moment, then Jackman said, Is there anyone in your group of supporters who you believe is capable of taking the law into his own hands, of committing terrible crimes to right a perceived wrong?
How can I answer that? Everyone was fired up at one point.
There was a time when I could have named quite a few like that, but now the flames burn low, and with a few exceptions, we're running out of steam.
None of those exceptions.
Mark Courtney seems as passionate as he ever was. And Art Pullen, well, he's just a constant, reliable Art, the girls call him. Every meeting, every rally, every protest, Art's there.
Jackman hadn't heard that name before.
And let's not forget my brothers.
Kenny's tone was somber.
The girls and I agree that as we run out of steam, the more enthusiastic Dale and Liam get.
What do you think will happen when your mother passes?
I've thought about that long and hard.
I believe the family will disintegrate, Inspector. Mother is the glue that holds us together. Unless she gives some deathbed edict that we have to obey, we'll all just fade away, like the pearled dew of May.
Where did you study at university, if I might ask?
Jackman made a bet with himself.
English literature.
I thought so, Jackman said. It explains your evocative language.
Kenny raised an eyebrow.
Purple prose. It's the mood I'm in at present.
Jackman stood up.
I'm sorry, this is an awful time for you. But please, if you think of anything or hear anything that could help us, just ring me.
Kenny stood up and looked thoughtfully at Jackman.
Mother trusts you. She's never trusted a copper before, and she's got good reason.
Can I ask? Do you know something about our Brendan? Could there be some new evidence that would prove his innocence?
Jackman had to remind himself that this man was still a possible suspect, despite his educated and pleasant manner.
Sorry, Kenny. Not yet. But as I said to your mother, we are going to take this whole case apart, so who knows what we might uncover.
Jackman left Kenny at the door, staring after him. As he got into his car, his phone rang.
Marie?
He listened and broke into a smile.
Brilliant. I'm on my way back. This could be what we've been waiting for. Well done.
It was lunchtime when Jackman got back. Even so, the CID room was full of officers.
How about an impromptu meeting, just to bring each other up to speed on where we are?
Everyone agreed. Jackman began with his opinions on Sheila and Kenny Simmons.
Dale, Liam and Susie were out when I called, so they are next in line for a chat. What luck did you have, Robbie?
In glorious technicolor, Robbie and Max described the pompous Christian Ventnor. Max added that they had had no luck with tracking down Sean Cooper. The neighbor said he was often around in the afternoons, so we'll try again. Marie reported on their meeting with Beatrice Harper. We're doing all we can to find out what happened to Lindsay's brother. If nothing else, he might have been a witness to her murder.
Jackman nodded. Nevertheless, keep up the interviews. But for the rest of your time, help Marie and Gary find Alistair Ashcroft, okay? And Charlie, any news from forensics on our double murder?
No, sir. Shall I ring the professor?
No. If he has anything for us, he'll let us know.
Marie raised her hand.
Shall I run this by Orak, sir? She seems to be able to access records that we've never even heard of. Perhaps she could help track down Alistair.
Good idea. You liaise.
Marie grinned.
Okay, folks, back to work.
Dear Jackman.
Jackman turned and saw the drawn face of Annie, the supervisor of the cleaning team.
Sorry to bother you, but could we clean the offices early today? We've had a bit of a week with illness and staffing problems, and I'm left with only Eric to do the whole station.
Jackman nodded.
No problem. Just let us know where you need to go.
He liked Annie. She was reliable and a hard worker. He couldn't say the same for Eric. He didn't even know the man. But he didn't appreciate people who went off and left their fellow workers to mop up their mess.
It's not like Stefan to be sick.
Poor lad, he's not sick, but his little kiddie is. She has some sort of congenital illness and apparently she's quite poorly this time.
I never knew, said Jackman.
Not many do. Stefan's not like Eric, who tells anyone who will listen all about his illnesses and his problems.
She lowered her voice.
Actually, sir, I've requested that Eric be moved from my team. He spends far too long chatting to the women. He's not a team player, sir, and I've had enough of him.
Good for you, Annie. Hope they agree.
Me too. And I'll make sure to do your office myself in future. Eric's been doing it, and although he spends a lot of time, he doesn't seem to get much cleaning done.
And it's time he moved on, Annie. Want me to endorse your recommendation?
I'm okay, sir. They'll take my word, I'm sure. I've worked for the company since it began 25 years ago. Annie grinned at him. I'll get my own way over this, you'll see.
Ella finished her chores early, running on nervous energy. She had phoned the school twice just to put her mind at rest, even though she knew there was a plainclothes police officer there, disguised as a trainee teaching assistant. What now?
There was only so much cooking, tidying up, and ironing you could do. She was beginning to understand how terrified Sarah must have felt. She hadn't seen the bad man herself. It had been the boys who had spotted him. But she believed them absolutely, and was certain he wasn't imaginary. True, Miles was artistic and sometimes fanciful, but she was sure that his nightmares were based on reality. Ryan was too serious to make up stories. Ella folded the boys' ironed pajamas and took them upstairs to the airing cupboard. She was just closing the door when she had an idea. It had been suggested that one of the police officers collect the boys from school. She had protested that she should continue as normal, to give the lads continuity. But what if she agreed to them being picked up? She could go to the school early and find a hidden spot from where she could watch the gates. If their bad man really was watching them, she might just see him for herself. She went back downstairs and thought it over. There was nothing to lose, and it was better than pacing the house, worrying herself sick. Should she tell Jackman? She pulled a face. He had more important things on his mind. She just hoped one of them wasn't Laura Archer. Ella flopped down into an armchair. She was sure there had been a spark of electricity between Jackman and Laura last night. The trouble was, she really liked Laura, which made it much worse. She jumped up again. This was stupid. She hadn't felt like this since the sixth form. Wasn't she a bit old to develop a crush? Action. That's what she needed. Something to take her mind off gorgeous detective inspectors. Ella pulled on a jacket and went to find her car keys. She'd talked to the police officer stationed at the entrance to the school drive and arranged for Ryan and Miles to have a police escort home. Meanwhile, she would do her own detective work. Brushing straw from her trousers, Harriet Jackman left the stable. Her newest acquisition, a rescue pony called Sherbet, was showing signs of improvement. Harriet ran a riding and livery stables, but occasionally someone would tell her a sad story of an animal that needed help, and before she knew it, she'd find herself with yet another mouth to feed. Sherbet had been left in a field with no shelter and only a matted old rug for protection. He had developed rain scald, a skin infection caused by persistent saturation, and his back and quarters had been covered in sores. Now the skin was healing, and the hair growing back, and Harriet was delighted. Sherbet was a grey Connemara pony that would be perfect for the boys. Connemaras were good-tempered and intelligent, and Harriet thought that having a pony of their own would be a wonderful way to lift their spirits. As she walked back across the yard, she saw one of her stable hands, a teenager called Erin, talking to a tall, rather good-looking man in a barber wax jacket and beige moleskin trousers. "Can I help?" she asked. "This gentleman was inquiring about stabling his horses with us, Mrs. Jackman." The man held out his hand. "I'm Edward Craven. I have to go abroad on business in a month's time, and sad to say I don't trust my daughters to give their horse sufficient care while I'm away. They're not bad girls, but their attention seems to be wandering from horses to boys, need I say more?" Harriet laughed. "Probably not. What breed is your horse, and how old is it?"
"She's a snowflake Appaloosa, Mrs. Jackman, 12 years old. Her name is Fleur. She's a docile creature and loves being ridden. Do you think you could take her?"
"I'll have to check the diary. Would you like to come across to the office, Mr. Craven?"
They strolled over to the stable's office, and Harriet opened the diary.
"Do you live round here?"
she asked.
"Oh, yes, and you came highly recommended."
The man grinned.
"Your son, actually. I met him at a function and we got talking horses. He told me about his lovely Arabian event horse, Glory."
Harriet smiled.
"I thought he was never going to get over the death of that horse. She was his world."
"So he said."
"So what dates are you looking at?"
Harriet looked up at him.
"Let's say exactly 1 month from now, and even if my trip is delayed, I'll know she's settled in."
Harriet found herself thinking that he would make a brilliant narrator for audiobooks. His voice was quite mesmerizing.
Yes, we can do that. I suggest we work on a weekly rate. Then if your trip is extended or shortened, you won't be paying more than you have to. Naturally, we will provide a contract, all the usual things, vets, farriers, insurance, stable rules, and so on.
Of course. I have transport, so I'll bring her myself.
He glanced at his watch.
Oh, is that the time? Lord, I have an appointment. Can you pencil me in and I'll ring you later with all my details?
He gave Harriet a mobile number.
We'll be pleased to look after her for you,
Harriet said.
Thank you so much and forgive me for being so rude, Mrs. Jackman. Give my best to your son. I'll ring tonight around 7.
Perfect. Hear from you then.
Harriet scribbled a note to remind herself to expect his call, then went to the pharmacy cupboard to work out Sherbet's next course of treatment. If he kept up this rate of recovery, in a few weeks' time her lovely grandsons would have a pony of their own. Once she had notified the police and the school of the temporary change of routine, Ella felt quite excited to be doing something positive. Part of her missed her old job as a scene of crime officer. It was something that made a difference. Prior to Harriet Jackman's request for help, Ella had been dangerously close to a serious breakdown. The plight of the Jackman boys had spurred her into action and given purpose to her life, and she knew that by the time the family no longer needed her, she would be capable of moving forward again. The school was situated at the bottom of a leafy tree-lined avenue. The parents parked along the avenue, and then gathered at the gates to wait for their chattering offspring to be released back into their care. Ella walked towards the school, looking for suitable places to conceal herself. She chose a spot a little to the left of the gates, on a grassy mound that housed a seat, a litter bin, and a few straggly bushes. Some parents would sit there and wait if they had arrived early, so she didn't feel too conspicuous. After all, she could hardly lurk behind a tree, could she? Better to just act naturally. Her view of the gates was about as good as it got, so she settled down with a book open on her lap and kept a careful eye on the gathering throng of parents. Some of them she knew by sight, a few she occasionally spoke to, and there were a couple of local women she remembered from her own school days. There were very few men in the company, and she recognized those from when she collected Ryan and Miles. She sat on, beginning to feel very silly. There was very little chance of Miles's bad man turning up every day. How often would she have to come here? And then, she saw someone she didn't recognize. A man stood at the back of the group. He was tall, wearing a black leather bomber jacket and black jeans. He wasn't watching the school gates. He was watching her. Ella realized that she'd stopped breathing. Then he made a small gesture, and it froze the blood in her veins. The man pointed to himself, lifted his hand and directed two fingers at his eyes, then aimed a finger at her. The message was as clear as it could possibly be. "I'm watching you." Ella sat, unable to move. She watched, rigid with fear, as he moved away from the crowd of waiting parents. Then all she could see was his back disappearing between the parked cars. For a moment she had no idea what to do. Then she pulled out her phone, ran Jackman, and sprinted towards the school gates just as they opened. All she could think of was that she wanted the boys in her arms.
Chapter 23. When Marie arrived in Orak's basement underworld, she was surprised to see a whole group of technicians hard at work. Generally, Orak worked alone or with just one or two assistants.
"Bad time?" she asked.
"No, no, come in, Marie."
Orak smiled at her, those disturbing eyes glinting in the half-darkness.
"Housekeeping, I'm cleaning."
Marie frowned. There were no dusters or polish in evidence.
"Cleaning out the crap that builds up in the systems. We can't afford to leave the smallest bit of info hanging around for some hacker to grab hold of. I run a tight ship, my friend."
Marie didn't doubt that for one second.
I need your help.
You or Jackman? There was a hint of amusement in Orak's voice.
Well, both, really. We wondered if you could trace a boy who went missing in 1995. It was assumed that he was sent to a special school for autistic children. He's never been seen since.
Orak ran the tip of her tongue across her lips. Sounds interesting. Give me what you have.
His name is Alistair Ashcroft, and his address was Ash Grange, Nettleby. Father, Charles, mother unknown. One sibling named Lindsay, aged around 9 when he was sent away. Said to have learning difficulties, possibly autism, and that's all we have.
That's plenty to be getting on with.
Orak spun her chair to face Marie.
Can I ask why you're interested in him?
He might have witnessed the murder of his sister, Lindsay Ashcroft.
She raised her eyebrows. That's a good reason to want to find him.
There is also an outside chance that he's our killer.
Then I'd better start work immediately, hadn't I?
Orak picked up a folder.
Before I forget, these are for you. The results of the checks I ran on Sarah's laptop. It's basically a string of locations, but what it comes down to is that Sarah's nemesis made the calls and sent the emails from here in Salton. We will never find the caller ID, but I'm guessing it doesn't even exist anymore. It's the best we can do.
Orak turned back to her screen. Still facing it, she said, "Something really bothers me about those two women's deaths."
Marie waited.
"Why London? Why not throw yourself in the Westland River? Jump from the local hospital roof. That's the tallest building round here. Why go all the way to London to kill yourself?"
Marie had been wondering the same thing.
"The only thing we can think of is that it was part of the killer's mind control scheme. Something else he threw in to screw their heads up even more."
"As in, you must go to London and do exactly what I tell you. Only then I will spare your children."
"Something like that. I'm guessing we'll only discover the real reason when we have the bastard sitting in an interview room."
"If he decides to tell you."
"He'd bloody well better," growled Marie.
She opened her mouth to continue, but a voice behind her called out,
"Marie, the boss wants you right now."
Robbie met her at the door.
"His nephew's nanny called him in a right panic. She reckons the killer was at the school gates at going home time."
Marie strode after him down the corridor.
"How would she know it was the killer?"
"He didn't say anything else. He wants you to go to the school with him."
"Of course I will. Oh, hell, this is all he needs. Another threat to his family."
She wondered to herself how Ruth Crook would see this latest development. She caught up with Jackman at the door.
"Want me to drive, sir?"
He handed her the keys. "Please, Marie. I want to ring Ella back, make sure nothing else has happened, and put your foot down, huh?" They reached the school in record time. Jackman was out of the car and running before Marie had put on the handbrake. She parked up and hurried in behind him. Ella was waiting in the head's office along with Ryan Miles and two plainclothes officers. Jackman asked whether there was CCTV. One of the officers, a PC named Chris Bourne, said he'd already requested the footage.
"They've just installed cameras to check on illegal parking. They're trying to get the parents to park further away from the gates."
Jackman turned to Ella.
"Maybe they've captured something then.
If, as you say, he was right there at the gates."
"He was, Jackman."
Ella looked more angry than shaken. "With all the parents. Then he ran down the avenue. He